Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast, the day after a long holiday weekend. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you by our friends at Plexiderm. Okay, gentlemen, that's a euphemism for Jim Swift and Andrew Egger of the Bulwark. Welcome back from the long holiday.
Hey, thanks for having us, Charlie.
Glad to be here.
It seems like an unusually depressing day for the news. Reading the stories about the mass shooting, that boat accident, and of course you have the president golfing while the vice president is off in Ireland at his golf club, and we're finding out now that apparently Mike Pence was the president had suggested to Mike Pence, just casually suggested to him, you should stay at my place, even though it's like a few hours away from Dublin.
It's not a grift, Charlie, because it's his ancestral homeland in Ireland, and his mom is along for the trip. But don't worry, taxpayers aren't paying for it. The Pences are paying for the family part.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get a breakdown in that. This is just a kind of a reminder, I suppose, that on Earth 2.0, this self-dealing would be a big story in and of itself, and it will probably last this news cycle. By the time people are listening to this podcast, people are going, "What? Ireland? Was Mike Pence actually in Ireland? Is there anything to that?" And of course, we're watching breaking stories. Apparently, Boris Johnson or potentially Boris Johnson has just lost his majority in the House of Commons. He's a detail. Did you watch that video? That one of the conservative MPs just walked across the floor, which is like a cool thing you can do in the British Parliament, and joined the opposition, the Liberal Party, which means that the conservative majority of one is now gone. So, and then we get to use the word prorogue the parliament. We can use phrases like that over the next several weeks, right? So, Brexit. But we have our own problems to deal with. We have the escalating trade war. We have, if you had to pick out one story that is the most significant today, does any random ones jump at you? And I'm guessing we'll have three different answers. And then we'll come back to the subject. So Jim Swift.
I'd say the hurricane. I mean, keep your eyes on the prize. There's always a Trump controversy. And of course, there are Trump, we can talk about this later, Trump controversies regarding the hurricane. But, we're talking about watching the Bahamas getting destroyed in many places.
Alabama.
Yes, Alabama, and that's where the president
is. It's going to hit Alabama.
Yeah,
when the president of the United States is tweeting about, hey, Alabama might get hit, and the Weather Service has to say, no, it's not in the Gulf. It's not going to hit Alabama. And the president is now like rage tweeting that, no, he was right all along.
Rain might go there. So he wasn't lying, as the defenders will say. But I think there was a piece I'd read about that. It was the Mooch, of course, was weighing in on this, saying like it's proof that he's unhinged, which I was saying long ago when he was insisting his father was born in Germany. The guy's not all there. But
okay. All right. So, Andrew. Story of the day.
Well, so this really isn't the story of the day, but I'm of a mind that it ought to be sort of the story of the week and the story of everything going forward. Obviously, the hurricane is hugely important and should be occupying all of our minds. But in terms of like the long-term thing, the thing that I'm looking at right now is still the trade war. It was last week's news. It was the week before that's news. And when something is every day's news, eventually people just sort of stop paying attention to it. But I think that's a big mistake. Okay. So we can talk about that too.
Yeah, I want to circle back on all of this. I can't get off of the story about the North Koreans and their use of flattery to advance their missile program. It's American and New York Times story. American intelligence officials and outside experts have come to a far different conclusion that the North Korean launchings that were downplayed by Trump, including two late last month, have allowed Mr. Kim to, I love the Mr. Kim thing, to test missiles with greater range and maneuverability that could overwhelm American defenses in the region. Mr. Kim's flattery of Mr. Trump with beguiling letters and episodic meetings offering vague assurances of eventual nuclear disarmament, some outside experts say, are part of what they call the North Korean leader's strategy of buying time to improve his arsenal despite all the sanctions on North Korea. Well, so the rest of the world has figured this guy out. You just suck up to him, you write him nice letters, and you go about doing what you're doing. I mean, this is one of those little episodes that we're going to look back in history and go, oh, God, how embarrassing that was.
It could be worse. He could be wishing them luck like he did the Iranians after their satellite blew up on the launch pad.
Yeah. Wow. That was that whole controversy was like 3 days ago, right? I've already forgotten all about it. Yeah. That's insane.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Blow
the
my
president
mind,
of the United States tweets out a highly confidential picture, right? But her emails. Okay. So this is not the biggest story of the day, but I will confess to being somewhat obsessed about it, at least at the moment. This Trump labor appointee who abruptly was forced to resign after Bloomberg writes this story about his alleged anti-Semitic Facebook post, which is clearly sarcastic. There is no reasonable way of reading it that is not that he's joking about, and he's talking about Paul Ryan's 70-point victory over bigot Paul Nehlen in the primary, and they're going back and forth. It's clearly not anti-Semitic, and yet this reporter, Ben Penn, not to be confused with our own Ben Penn, goes with this story, Trump labor aide quits after anti-Semitic Facebook post. And of course, he's now being dragged mercilessly, as I think he deserves, on Twitter. So Andrew Egger, what the hell is this about?
So let's start. The guy's name is, I believe, Leif Olson. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Was an appointee to a Department of Labor post. And I'll just read a bit of his what he posted on Facebook a couple years back, August 2016. So you can get a flavor of it. Establishment insider rhino corporate tool Paul Ryan was finally brought to heel in tonight's primary election by an uprising of the conservative masses of real America, eager for an authentic voice in Washington instead of the same tired globalist open borders pap they've been pushing on us since the elites abandoned the people. The guy just suffered a massive, historic, emasculating 70-point victory. Let's see him and his Georgetown cocktail party puppet masters try to walk that one off. So obviously this is very much our speed, right?
This is how we joke on this podcast.
Right. So it's transparently a joke post, right? And the thing he gets in trouble for is a little bit later on down, somebody comments he's a neocon too, you know, and this appointee posts, no, he's not. Neocons are all Upper East Side Zionists who don't golf on Saturday, if you know what I mean. So he's making jokes, about this idea that, you know, Paul Nehlen and a lot of these other alt-right types are obsessed with the fact that the Jews control the media, right? So that's
and the weather, right?
Right. Well, yes, and that's a slightly different shade of the shade of the conspiracy, but so. Transparently a joke post, right? So a Bloomberg reporter, this Benjamin Penn, unearths this post, sends it to the Department of Labor, like, hey, you have a comment about this anti-Semitic post? And the Department of Labor emails him back right away, and we're like, and they say, we just accepted his resignation. So it's this whole huge, you know, cluster of a story where this clear joke post has now sort of ended this guy's current gig with the Department of Labor. There's plenty of blame seemingly to go around. I mean, this Ben Penn guy is continuing to characterize this as anti-Semitic posting from this guy.
And in the story, the Ben Penn adds this sort of context about the quote unquote controversy of Leif Olson was that, you know, he tried running for a judgeship in Texas. He lost, but he represented pro-traditional marriage clients or something like that. Some on the right are saying this is why they wanted his scalp.
Right. Well, so it's very much just sort of like presumption of guilt, like hermeneutic of suspicion stuff from the reporter. It was very much just a case of the Department of Labor just sort of rolling over in sort of a shocking way to try to avoid apparently bad press, bad news, things like that. It's just kind of looks bad for everybody who you'd want a story like this to look good for, and it's bad for people who actually want to call out real anti-Semitism. It's good for people who want to equivocate about that and just say that all charges of anti-Semitism are sort of spurious and want to muddy the waters in this way. It's just really kind of a small story, but it's gross sort of all the way through.
And so let's break it down into the three elements that you've broken it down to. You know, first the story, number two, the Department of Labor and the Department of Labor, you know, instant reaction. And then, of course, you know, the fallout from it. And, you know, and I think it was last week, did we have, or was the week before, Batya Unger Sargon was on. I love her name, by the way, you know. about Unger Sargon. She was on, she tweeted out, she said, "One thing you see a lot of in our current age is an inability to detect humor in people that we perceive to be our political enemies and the extreme effects that can have. Who knew that humor was an important factor in a functioning democracy?" So here you have this case of someone, you know, mocking anti-Semitic politician. Clearly, as you point out, it was a joke post. It was humorous. And clearly, this reporter did not recognize the humor at all, because he figures this guy's bad, this guy's evil, this guy, you know, is somebody that, you know, we ought to drag. And so he then writes to the Department of Labor, you know, having totally missed the humor, and the Department of Labor caves in an incredibly short period of time, which I also find stunning. You know, this is an administration that, you know, is sort of notorious for not vetting. So have they now gone to the other extreme, which is to assume that any hint of anything, any sort of inquiry, means that they have to cave in?
Here's my word of caution, that when I was reading this story commuting in today and I was seeing it, I'm like, oh my gosh, these people are missing the joke. And you're right, to a point about vetting, they're so bad at this that a little voice in my head was watching people that I like and respect say, give him his job back. And if this is all that there is, that is known, of course she shouldn't be forced to resign. I mean, this is nuts. But it occurred to me that there is a non-zero chance that another reporter has already contacted the Department of Labor about something that is not a joke and is really bad, and we just don't know it yet. So I'm seeing lots of people say, give him his job back. I think focus on the known knowns here.
Well, it's a job of commentary to say that it was stupid for the Department of Labor to cave in. Here's a known known, that if Bloomberg had something more substantive on the guy, wouldn't they have gone for this rather than the bullshit story?
Well, and focus on Bloomberg's reporting here. Clearly, the reporter missed the joke. And then in adding the other context, I don't think it's unfair to suggest that this guy, you know, the reporter added that context in there. What does his failed judgeship and views on gay marriage have to do with a joke about Paul Nehlen?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Now, speaking of Paul Nehlen, because of course he's as a Wisconsin guy, I go way back with Paul Nehlen.
Me too.
Go way back with this guy, including when he ran against Paul Ryan in 2016, and all the Breitbart guys were all, you know, in on him, and every single day they ran a story about how he was gaining in momentum, and you had Laura Ingraham who flew in here, and Ann Coulter and
Michelle Malkin,
and it was just about everybody, and it was, you know, this was the big race, and Paul Nehlen was an idiot. He was a bigot. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my book called "The Bigots Among Us," which was about Paul Nehlen, and during that campaign in 2016, suggesting that all Muslims be deported. I mean, he went beyond a Muslim travel ban. He was suggesting, well, because Muslims believe in Sharia law or whatever, that maybe we should round them up. And so I talk about that in the book. And then, of course, despite all of the Breitbart drum beating and predictions of this imminent upset, he managed to get something like 15% of the vote. And this is what, in this story, this Leif Olson is mocking the fact that, that Paul Ryan, we really taught him a lesson. He only won by 70 points in this election. Well, so a year later, let's go a year later. This is not August 2016, but let's go to, bear with me here, August 14th. This is an important date. August 14th, 2017. Now, just put this in context. This is right after Charlottesville, right after the Unite the Right rally, the racist violence and everything. This is my deep sigh. Let's go to Joe Walsh's radio show back then, which he devoted mainly to, you know, how Charlottesville was, in fact, both sides. And then he had this very, very special guest. Let's play a little bit of the audio.
Excited right now. Because I am joined on the phone by a guy that I want everybody listening to me right now to get behind. His name is Paul Nehlen. He's running against Paul Ryan in the Republican primary in 2018. Speaker Paul Ryan. Paul Nehlen, my friend, thank you so much for joining us. I don't know that I've ever told you this, but I say it on air a lot. I think Paul Ryan's the most overrated member of Congress.
Okay, so this is the part of the problem with Joe Walsh, is that this is not lost in the distant mists of time, guys. This is less than 2 years ago, and it's Paul Nehlen. And Paul Nehlen had not gone full Nazi. He didn't go full Nazi until the next year.
Because he was running. He was running again.
He's announcing that he's running again. Absolutely. And Walsh is like all in. I mean, he gives out the, you know, says everybody's got to support him. Everybody's got to contribute money to him. He gave out the website over and over again, my dear friend and everything. He was completely all in on this. So it's not only recent, but it's you know, an example of just truly bad judgment and just kind of a reminder that, you know, I like Joe Walsh. I have a piece, you know, in the Bulwark today saying the problem with Joe Walsh, you know, and as an ally, I think it's great. You know, as a spokesman, as a newly woke spokesman, fabulous. But Joe Walsh for president is just freaking nuts. And this is just a reminder of it. And I understand how, you know, we're in this, you know, we beggars can't be choosers and everything. But I did think that Jonah Goldberg had a good, you know, point. He said, look, you can't say I'm standing on principle in my opposition to a bigoted troll and con man as the leader of my party and my country. And that's why I'm supporting a less successful bigoted troll and con man for president. I mean, you know, whatever the question is, Joe Walsh is not the answer. And I'm reluctant to say this because he's been a guest on this podcast. You know, I'm sure you guys know him. I like him personally. I like the things he's saying right now. But I do think that there's this moment to go, you know, if you're going to be a convert and you're going to apologize, you ought to allow a little more time to pass from shilling for somebody like Paul Nehlen to asking us to support you for president of the United States.
Right. Well, you know, Joe Walsh and I have retweeted one another's content from time to time, which is pretty much as close to being real bosom friends as you get in this godforsaken town. But I largely agree with that, Charlie. I mean, you can quibble about, you know, how much of the things in his old tweets are sort of like for effect. He has said, you know, that he was basically playing a character there. He wasn't really, you know, saying things he actually meant. But honestly, for my money. And I don't want to just like dogpile on Walsh, but that is the thing that really stuck with me is the fact that his claim now is that he was basically just doing a bit with all that stuff before, that it wasn't sort of ideologically a Nehlenite. That was just sort of where the action was for him right at that time, and so he dipped into that. And that's what's particularly troubling to me is just, you know, It's bad to have bad politics. It's bad to say bad things. But the lasting stain, at least as far as I'm concerned, is just the admission that you are the kind of person who would, you know, just sort of do a bit, you know, who would just say a bunch of inflammatory stuff for no reason except to sort of make money, posture yourself in the correct place politically. And obviously it's possible to come back from that. It should be possible to come back from anything. You know, I'm sure we're all sort of in agreement
Glenn
about
Beck did that for a while.
Well, yeah. And that's the trick is you have to stick around for it in order for people to start to buy it.
Well,
you shouldn't be able to expect people to buy it instantly. You should stick around.
Right.
You should put in the time and you should,
sure.
You know.
Well, there's also two separate points here. I mean, number one, you know, Donald Trump, the man, and then there is the cancer of Trumpism. And you can't sort of break those apart. I mean, as I wrote this morning, I mean, you know, it is easy to be distracted by Donald Trump's character, you know, the erratic narcissism, the lying, the bullying, all of that. But there's obviously also, you know, a pre-existing dysfunction in the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And that's something that we're going to have to confront at some point. And Joe Walsh, by his own admission, I mean, he was Trump before Trump. I mean, he was in terms of the and he admits that he's had racist tweets. He says, yes, I've said racist things, but I'm not a racist. Not a great slogan. But, you know, his position on immigration, his position on a lot of things, including his alliance with people like Paul Nehlen, we would not have allied ourselves with him before Trump. And so why would we do it after Trump? He represents a strain in the Republican Party that I think many of us, or I'm speaking for myself, you know, had pushed against for many, many years. So it's kind of a weird thing to
Well, unless he doesn't represent that anymore, right? And that's the rub. Like that's what, you know, takes some time to ferret out.
Well, I think there's no obligation to support him. And the way I've always kind of viewed, I was in line at the DMV the other day, and they had a sign up, you know, it was trying to encourage people to go online. It says, "You have options." And I made that my Twitter cover. And I'm a more the merrier sort of guy. And it could be that a Joe Walsh candidacy is not meant for Andrew Egger, Jim Swift, or Charlie Sykes.
Right.
And that's fine. And I view it as, and one thing that's kind of bothered me, and I think it's fine to go after Walsh, and a lot of commentators on the right are doing so and saying, is his conversion sincere? Is this another grift? You know, is this all another bit? Is this just kind of a chameleon sort of thing? Those are all fair and good questions to ask. And I don't think anyone should feel obligated to support any one candidate. And a side note, the Bulwark, since we are a nonprofit, does not support any specific candidate and cannot do so under the law. But I view it as like a choice. I put this in my newsletter. I view it as a choice of ice cream. If you are a conservative voter, you have a choice between the gold-flaked churro bowl with vanilla, or you kind of have this choice of a Neapolitan ice cream of other options. You know, Bill Weld might be vanilla, and if Mark Sanford gets in, he might be chocolate, and Joe Walsh might be strawberry. And strawberry is the most controversial flavor in Neapolitan ice cream. You know, or maybe someone else could run too. But the attacks on Walsh, many and most of which are fair, I think. Coming from what I would call the anti-Trump right, sort of bother me because at the end of the day, I mean, not every pundit out there on the right works in a place where they are, you know, required to endorse someone. We work at a place where we cannot endorse someone. But seeing a lot of these things, you can also say dessert is not something I want to eat, and I'm going to leave it blank. But there are other options.
Well, thank you for that extended metaphor about
about desserts.
Desserts,
but
I guess
held up.
I just don't know where you say yes. We're with him except for the racism,
right?
I mean, kind of. Didn't we do this? Haven't we been through this?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I might personally am going to vote. I mean, I don't even know what the Democratic primary might look like. And Andrew and I live in Virginia, where you can vote in either primary. And you know, if the choice is cast a vote for one of these challengers that, you know, they're not going to beat Trump in a primary or help save the Democrats, you know, from nominating far left person.
I think there's an equal and opposite reaction, which, you know, some of our other friends were going, you know, I will vote for any Democrat, including socialist Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
You know, at this point, I think, you know, part of the difficulty is keeping your head about you and all, you know, everybody else is losing theirs. It's you can't go along with somebody like a Joe Walsh, but it's equally just bizarre to say, yes, you know, because of Donald Trump, we are going to embrace a socialist who is promising to transform every aspect of American society. Everything that we claim to believe in, we are going to get rid of. But I understand that part of the problem is that when American democracy completely loses its freaking mind, it's hard to come up with a rational choice.
And it's never a binary one. You could just leave it blank.
Charlie, well, before we get too far afield, you were talking about, you know, sort of this reckoning, right? This the difference going from sort of the ground as we all thought we saw it prior to Trump to whatever's going to happen after. And one other thing about just Paul Nehlen, as far as he relates to all that, is I do think we should sort of see him as sort of a watershed figure when it comes to that that transition, right? Because I do think that. Especially, you know, prior to Trump, it's always been sort of a conservative staple that things aren't as bad as they seem for people on the right, that people aren't as bad as the mainstream media makes them look, that you know, deep down everybody just holds these same conservative principles, and mostly when guys like Paul Nehlen are here and their, you know, their bad stuff is dredged up and plastered all over the media, the reaction has been to sort of turtle in and defend our guy and all those sorts of things. But what I think we've seen from Nehlen is that, you know, a lot of times what's happening is not that a guy who is saying some conservative things and some just inflammatory sort of reactionary things is actually a conservative at heart, but just that he has been sort of passing for a while as just sort of a grassroots regular guy insurrectionist you know, the kind of guy that you know, the radio hosts and things should get behind. But that's the part that isn't real. And then when he loses that buttress, it quickly becomes clear that where this guy's actual priorities lie is being, you know, basically a neo-Nazi. And it's and so that's the fact that things can fall the other way. You know, the fact that actually these people can be super fringy and just sort of posing as, you know, as you know, they walk among us. I think that's something that, you know, that we didn't necessarily reckon with as much as we ought to have before, and we'll need to continue to do so.
Well,
more now.
And that's why, you know, did we learn anything from this lesson of you know, the enemy, my enemy is my friend? I do understand the appeal of that, but
that's what Trump did with Nehlen.
That is largely what Trump did with Nehlen. And as I point out in the piece, people can read the whole thing at the Bulwark. I focused on this April 14th date of this Joe Walsh show. I mean, 2 days before that, there had been reports that Nehlen had in fact retweeted praise of the Unite the Right rally. He retweeted a picture of the demonstration posted by the organizer Jason Kessler. You know, I mean, and then a few days before this, Nehlen had also embraced that fringe conspiracy theory known as Pizzagate. So it was not like Paul Nehlen was not a known quantity. So here's Joe Walsh not just being Trumpian, but being just like super uber Trumpian. And so I just think that's part of look, in the absence of Trump, I think we would say these are disqualifying things, you know, and that's where we're at. Okay, so I want to get into some more substantive things rather than engaging in this civil war, because as I started off on this piece today, I didn't really want to write this because Bill Kristol is a colleague and I kind of like Joe Walsh, so I had to get it off my chest that the Joe Walsh for president thing is a terrible, terrible idea. But let's talk about where we are at after a really shambolic summer for the president. And there have been a number of stories that point out how Donald Trump's August was just nuts, and a great Washington Post piece is saying, you know, that this, you know, the summer was really a lost opportunity for the president. And one of the fallouts from the summer is that the trade war is on us and looks like it's going to get worse. And I want to talk to you guys about that. But first, here's a word from our friends at Plexiderm.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear, so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit tryplexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's tryplexiderm.com.
Okay, we're back with Andrew Egger and with Jim Swift. Okay, Andrew, let's talk about where we are at on the trade war. As of this week, some of these new tariffs kick in, and we don't look like we are any closer to a deal with the Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, that's in one sense, it's exactly the same story that we've heard, you know, five or six times now, right? Like almost every plot point looks exactly the same. Trump gets mad and he, you know, gets impatient with the Chinese that they haven't caved yet. He decides to throw on some more tariffs. The Chinese respond by, you know, going blow for blow with him, throwing on more tariffs of their own. Republicans sort of get sort of wide-eyed and they're sort of shifty. They're like, "Mr. President, I don't know about this," and they sort of trying to tap him on his shoulder and you know, at least get some clarity about how long this is going to last or anything like that. But Donald Trump is the tariff terminator, and he can't be reasoned with and he can't be pleaded with. He's just going to keep doing this. And the interesting thing for me in this latest round of tariffs, and we are sort of approaching, if we have not already, you know, sort of passed an inflection point where, you know, previously the tariffs were bad for a select few industries, right? I've been writing for years now about how absolutely screwed over U.S. agriculture has been by this trade war since, since the opening months of this thing. But you know, agriculture is small. I mean, it's really bad for the farmers, but I mean, just if you're talking in terms of just aggregate impact on the economy, the Trump economy has had a lot of, you know,
well,
not a lot of runway.
Can I raise my hand here? Not in Wisconsin.
No. Well, the market and the economy are not the same thing.
Well, okay.
Yeah, no, I understand.
No,
yeah.
So you're right about that. I'm just saying that, you know, certain things that Trump
elites
has done have definitely helped. I mean, I just think it's undeniable in the tax cuts, and especially, you know, a lot of deregulation has been good for business. Trump's been a very pro-business president. He's juiced, let's say, the markets at least. And so he's given himself more runway with this stuff. The problem is that Trump can't really just like snap his fingers and make a change, right? I mean, if these tariffs now start to spill over and have broader and broader economic impacts and slow us more and more, potentially even tip us into a recession, at that point you can't just say, oh, well, I've changed my mind, take off all the tariffs, and expect things to, you know, pop right back up to where they were before, because these things have lasting consequences that far outweigh you know, just what's happening right now. We're destroying our trade relationship with China. I mean, it's a billion.
And these things are dictated by commodities futures, you know, market versus economy. I mean, once you lose this market, I mean, it takes a long time for this to get back.
Exactly. And so this is the moment where you need to act. This is the moment where, if you are Republicans in the Senate, you should be feeling the pressure most, because you're running out of time. But what we're seeing is that it's the opposite of that happening. That Republicans were squirming more in the first few rounds of tariffs than they seem to be now, and it seems to be that the reason for that is only because we've heard this story so many times, people start to tune it out, and senators start to feel as though the pressure is off a little bit, and it's really a problem.
If Barack Obama pulled this shit, and I realize now we're going to have to be E for explicit, but if Obama pulled this shit, I remember what House Republicans did during the August recess in, what was it, like 2008? They held sit-ins in the chamber, and they're like, no, Speaker Pelosi and the Democrats, gas prices are too high. We can't go back to our constituents unless we act on this. If Obama had been doing this, Republicans would be holding sit-ins in the House chamber, bringing constituents in and talking about how bad the tariffs are, how bad they're hurting economic communities, how bad that it's socialism, that we're having to basically take money from other taxpayers to give specifically to farmers. They would have had a field day with this. And, you know, now it's just they're sitting on their hands. But as Andrew said, I mean, we've long passed the point of no return. The money is not getting to farmers. Guys are saying that this is, you know, hitting them, you know, in many six figures. And while there aren't tons of family farms like there used to be in like the 1800s, most of it's kind of corporate. There are still people who are family farmers who work for big corporations. And those entities make decisions based on futures and markets. And, you know, if they don't want your soybeans anymore, you know, because there's not a market for them, you better find something else to grow. And you can't just pivot from being a soybean specialist, you know, for 20 years.
This is the sort of thing that isn't new news. You know, we've known about this forever, but that doesn't make it less pressing. You know what I mean? Like fully half of like U.S. soybeans were going to China before all this went down. That was, you know, where we sold soybeans to, because what soybeans are used for is hog feed, and China has enormous amounts of pork that they feed their people with over there. And so that's just gone now. And that's, you're right, that's not coming back. I mean, like it'll take a long time. You know, I was writing about this, you know, in late 2017, how you know, farmers were making a killing in, or late 2018, I should say.
You had a
farmers
cover story.
Were. Yeah, I did actually. Farmers were making farmers in Brazil were just sort of raking in the money hand over fist with this unexpected weakness from the American market going into China. They start selling all their beans to China. They start pouring that money into improving their own infrastructure, lessening America's competitive advantage over Brazil in the global market for these things. I mean, the real consequences, they're happening, and sort of the. They've been happening for a long time, and the grim reality of it is basically that the choice we're presented with now is: are we going to keep these sort of horrific reconfigurations to our own disadvantage of the markets, restricted to a few small, relatively small sectors like agriculture? Is it just the farmers who are going to get screwed, or
no,
is everybody going to get screwed?
Like,
and that's pretty much the choice that is facing
coffee,
us right now.
Coffee, flowers, peppers, a lot of these things are grown in South America. And if they start replacing certain crops with other things, eventually that will, you know, impact completely unrelated American consumers. And that's, you know, I mean, that's the Scott Linsicum argument about tariffs, which I won't repeat here because we had him on for an excellent podcast last week.
So will this make a political difference among rural voters? Despite all of this, of course, at one time the political model was it's the economy stupid and people would vote their pocketbooks. But I think it's a legitimate question whether or not this is actually going to make a difference, whether this will, in fact, get rural voters to say, yeah, we're going to vote for Democrats, because I can see a whole host of social, cultural, tribal issues that basically make this a wash.
Yeah, so there's something to that. There's basically two points we made. The one is that one, and the other is a lot of the Democrats running have relatively similarly protectionist trade policies to what Trump is running on. I mean, they have people like Elizabeth Warren have distanced themselves from Trump's trade war, but basically Elizabeth Warren's pitch is just I'm just going to fight a good trade war. So there is that also. And as far as the actual sort of likelihood or the numbers, I've seen some polling that indicates Trump is slipping in some of these areas. I don't know whether that is the case or not. I'll say any conversation that I have ever had with farmers, and I used to report on this stuff relatively regularly, and some of these same people even these days, they're taking it in the chin, but essentially their outlook has been, we see ourselves as kind of foot soldiers in this trade war, right? Like that China is punishing us because they know we're a political pressure point. That's why they went off after ag products in the first place, because they knew we're vulnerable and we're not going to punish, the president that we support because China's putting pressure on us. The problem for Trump, I think, is that, again, as this spills out of agriculture into other markets, there are a lot of people who didn't sign up to be, foot soldiers in the trade war who are getting conscripted all of a sudden. You see what I mean?
Yeah, and you don't need to have a significant erosion, just a couple of percentage points in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and things slip. Okay, let me just throw this at you because I have to deal with this a little bit later on a different program. The way that the gun issue is playing, I mean, there's that new Quinnipiac poll out saying that voters say by a margin of 60-34% that we ought to have stricter gun laws in the United States. 60% now say they support a nationwide ban on assault weapons, including 37% of Republicans. I mean, some of these numbers are pretty impressive. 93% support universal background checks, 82% support requiring a license to purchase a gun, 80% support red flag laws, 60%, as I mentioned, assault weapon ban, 46-49 split on mandatory buybacks of assault weapons, which is really gun confiscation. My guess is that's a little bit inflated. So at this point, how does the gun issue play in 2016, do you think, Mr. Swift?
You mean 2020?
I'm sorry, 2020.
So I'm a very pro-gun guy. I own guns. I have a history of supporting guns, and I know probably more about guns than most people around these parts. And I see two conversations happening in the public space. The one that really doesn't matter is the one on Twitter, where Dana Loesch and Shannon Watts and pro-gun guys on the right, and I think a lot of pro-gun people that I've seen, because I used to be a member of the NRA, and when they became the it of the Republican Party, I said, not for me. And, just like Planned Parenthood, as we've joked, has become the it of the Democrats. And, it's one thing to stick to guns, and I've written for both the Standard and less so here, I think in my newsletter a little bit, about guns. But the conversations that you see on Twitter between, conservative gun experts, and I guess you would call them liberal gun experts, though they tend to get lots of things wrong, is the conservatives keep saying, well, how can you regulate something you know nothing about? Okay, that's a fair point as someone who, worked in legislation and whatnot. But that's not legislating and conversations about legislature and fixes and laws and things like that. That's not the same conversation that people have. People have conversations about the trade war in which they know nothing about. They don't know about the WTO. They don't know about countervailing duties. They don't know about dumping. They don't know about the harmonized tariff code. They might not know what an assault
rifle is. Quit making up words, Jim.
They might not know what an assault rifle is. They might not know the difference between a bolt action, a semi-automatic, and a fully automatic, or what a bump stock or a silencer are. But it doesn't mean that they can't have views on these topics, and it doesn't mean that they can't vote on what they feel. And Republicans, Democrats, and Bill made this point a number of years ago, is Obama had an opportunity to use political capital in the wake of, one of the number of mass shootings that took place under his presidency, and basically chose not to do it. Sandy Hook, for example, I mean, that being most prevalent, or I mean, most
prominent
on people's minds. he chose not to expend that capital. We might be seeing a shift now where...
Wait. I really had the sense that President Obama went all in on gun legislation after Sandy Hook.
Went all in what respect? I mean, nothing went anywhere.
Which political capital was he supposed to spend that he didn't spend? I'm just trying to remember this.
Yeah. You could have, one example would be you could have vetoed a funding bill that would deny the, Health and Human Services the ability to study gun deaths and mental illness and stuff like that. There are tangible things you could have done, throwing the baby out with the bathwater or doing more executive orders, which
I want to switch back to the main question. How does this play next year? I mean, obviously, this is going to... this alienates suburban voters. We've been talking a lot about urban, suburban voters. I think, and so that's a real problem for Republicans up and down ballot, I think. On the other hand, if the Democrats, and we've had this conversation so many times, follow the Beto O'Rourke strategy of talking about gun confiscation, I could see this actually hardening Republican support, Trump support in some of the rural areas to get that base ginned up so that the numbers in some ways might be a little bit misleading.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, pretend you're a soybean farmer in Missouri and you don't like the six-figure hit you've taken to your business, but you're an avid hunter and you also like collecting guns. You might just say, well, I mean, this is killing my business, but that guy literally is campaigning on sending armed agents to my house to take my guns. I'm going to vote for Trump.
So, Andrew, when I'm looking at these numbers showing basically a split on the mandatory gun buyback, I'm thinking that understates opposition to that, because I'm not sure that voters at this point fully understand that mandatory gun buybacks is gun confiscation. And that once the NRA and the Republicans make that case, those numbers are going to shift, and they're going to shift in areas that are going to be crucial for the 2020 election.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I do think, not just on the gun issue, we see over and over again that sort of the way you frame a question in a poll to a person who doesn't necessarily have a lot of, previous information about the poll. There's a lot of "that sounds good to me" sort of
right.
polling that gets out there. The polling, and I'm no gun expert, I'm no gun policy expert, but even I know that the polling for gun confiscation has never looked good in America, just sort of period. That's why, it's sort of a product of this race to the left that we've seen, the byproduct of this, jungle primary where people are afraid in the Democratic Party to get out of lockstep with the furthest left version of every policy issue. But I do think it's going to be a huge liability if whoever the eventual Democratic nominee is can't stick to, the sorts of gun policy solutions that are sort of wildly popular, even when they are kind of understood. Things like, universal background checks and red flag laws and those sorts of things.
Joe Biden understands this, I think, because unlike the Beto O'Rourke thing where he said, we're going to have gun buybacks because gun buybacks sound, less scary than ATF agents showing up at your house and demanding you give the guns that you refuse to sell back to the government.
People who own guns love selling guns.
But Biden said, with Mitch McConnell at the helm, we're never going to get a compromise of any sort. So if we want to get anything, we have to beat him. And that's just sort of saying, hey, maybe we'll get to specifics if I get to the general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do think this is one of those issues that that they can turn from being an absolute winner into being a wash by emphasizing the wrong things. And Beto O'Rourke is in this very strange position right now. Look, like, you guys know me, so you know that I'm not squeamish about the use of language. I mean, even on this podcast,
we're already explicit.
We have dropped F-bombs in the past, but there's something just watching Beto O'Rourke think that, saying that things are effed up, and making T-shirts out of it, that this is his brand now, that he's the guy willing to drop F-bombs.
Right. Yeah. You never want your profanity to be your personality, right?
Or your merch.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's not going to get him any sort of traction. And of course, as he doubles down on this particular issue, Beto O'Rourke ought to run for Senate in Texas line, which I have pushed, seems a lot less plausible. But then, I've gotten used to being wrong and ignored. So
Obama did it. They had the BFD shirts, didn't they?
I don't remember that.
From Obamacare, where Biden said it was a big...
Oh, yeah.
That was Biden. I suppose Biden actually, in many ways, was the trailblazer in the dropping of the F-bomb.
Biden looks cool and earthy when he swears, and Beto sort of looks like an eighth grader. I mean, it's just that it's optics, you know. We're doing optics, but it's true.
No one can beat Dick Cheney's major league assholes, though. That, for me, always is number one vice presidential swearing.
So, Andrew, you're younger than Beto O'Rourke,
oh,
right?
Yeah. I'm a lot younger than that. I could not run for forever.
Okay, so, see, I would normally, see, if I said something like, you know, Beto O'Rourke looks in eighth grader, it's like, you know, old man yelling at the, you know, get off my lawn. But even you're seeing this, that he looks callow. The word callow just comes to mind.
Yeah,
the guy is a kid, he's immature, there is nothing about him that says, hey, this is the guy we ought to make commander-in-chief.
Yeah, look, Charlie, perhaps years down the road, I make a drastic career change and somehow land in a presidential primary, I promise you that my preeminent selling point for my campaign is not going to be, ooh, I want the guy who swears on cable news.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you so much for all your time on this Tuesday after Labor Day. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast, which was brought to you today by Plexiderm. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.